Hi, Carrie.
Hi, Carrie.
I'm Carrie Howley from Reason Magazine.
And I'm Carrie Seedstra from IBIS Reproductive Health.
And this is Blogging Heads. And we're going to talk about Burma, among other things, today. Myanmar is back in the news. Of course, as usual, the focus is on the democracy movement and Aung San Suu Kyi and her trial, which I believe has closed. We don't have a decision yet, but regarding her culpability for housing an American overnight, which is a fascinating trial in various ways I hope we can talk about later. But mostly we want to hear from you, Carrie, because you have some really fascinating experience in the region. Why don't you tell everyone what you do?
Sure. For most of the last 2.5 years, I've been spending about half of my time working along the Thai-Burma border. And my work is around reproductive health. And I do a variety of things with a number of NGOs in the U.S. and also community groups on the border. And one of them that I'm most interested in really sharing with folks today is work with adolescents. There's a huge number of adolescents who flee eastern Burma where, I know, Carrie, there's been this ongoing civil war for most of the last 60 years. And so they flee into Thailand where they try to find work illegally in factories or in restaurants or construction sites. And they're often alone and they're often really lacking in education and resources. And so this group, Adolescent Reproductive Health Network, which is made up of local Burmese organizations, has worked really hard to give them some basic education and supplies around reproductive and sexual health since they're such a vulnerable population.
So I kind of sense that we're going to have had experience of two very different Burmas, and that I was mostly in Rangoon. I traveled a lot, but in my experience, the Burmese in Rangoon or Yangon or whatever you want to call it were relatively cosmopolitan. They were watching Korean soap operas. They had some knowledge of the region. They had the teen magazines and various other ways of conveying cultural cues. And it's going to be really different for Burmese in northern Burma. What was the level of knowledge about just basic things like menstruation?
Really low. Part of our information, most of our information comes from a recent survey that the Adolescent Reproductive Health Network did. And part of the reason that's really fascinating is that we have so little information about people in eastern and northern Burma. And so the survey asked, in particular, what do you know about sex? What do you know about menstruation? It turned out, that almost a third of the girls who were interviewed weren't aware of what menstruation was and were quite frightened by it. And almost half of the boys and the girls reported that they didn't have any formal information about sex or sexual anatomy. And so this is a group that is really flying blind in a way that we don't see in most populations in Southeast Asia. I think your experience in Rangoon is really typical for most countries there, that teens have magazines, they have access to TV, there's a lot of pop culture. Then you get to eastern Burma, which has been in this low-level or, more intense-level counterinsurgency warfare since World War II. And people are so isolated still from the rest of the world. Most villages only have kindergartens, sometimes first or second grades. There really aren't much in the way of schools. There aren't clinics. There aren't healthcare delivery systems. And so when people end up in Thailand, it's a really different population than, say, democracy activists or dissidents who also end up in Thailand. Mm-hmm. Those people, like you said, are very sophisticated. They have high levels of education. They're quite fluent with the rest of the world. And people who are coming from the mountains and valleys of eastern Burma are just in a totally different context, trying to navigate Thailand and world culture.
I'm really curious about what the sort of cultural attitudes are toward reproductive health and abortion in particular. My experience in Rangoon was that abortion was formally illegal, but it was happening quite openly in various hospitals, and that there wasn't the kind of like fraughtness you might experience in a Christian or Muslim country, but there also wasn't sort of open discussion of it. Certainly, we could never print anything about that in the newspaper I worked for.
It's funny. It's very different in Thailand because unsafe abortion can be discussed inside Thailand in terms of Burmese populations, right? It's quite mm-hmm. possible to say that, well, we have really high levels of unsafe abortion happening. But at the same time, because there's been such a strong missionary presence inside mm-hmm. Eastern Burma, and because there are many small ethnic groups in Eastern Burma that are quite concerned about possible genocide and the elimination of themselves as a people, there are much stronger, I think, taboos about abortion. And so the religious pushback about abortion can be quite strong. But in the same way that's true all over Burma, because of people's poverty, malnutrition, just difficulty in taking care of more children, abortion rates are very high, and death from unsafe abortion is very common. It's one of the leading causes of maternal mortality. So it's an important subject to deal with both adolescents and with adult women and families. But it is very tricky sometimes to talk honestly about the harms from unsafe abortion and acknowledge it happens without, in any way touching on people's sensitivities that in many communities it's perceived as being very bad and a sin.
So what are the methods of unsafe abortion? I mean, it's interesting when you're talking about abortion politics in a Western context, you're generally talking about these sorts of cultural constraints, but I mean, it's just the dire poverty. I think I was reading in maybe the report you sent me that public health spending is like $4 per person per year. So what are the methods available when safe medical abortions aren't available?
Sure. I think it's an important lesson for all sorts of areas of the world. And in terms of debates in many countries, including the U.S., where we talk about legality and access, because when women don't have access to safe abortion methods and when there isn't access to doctors who might perform safe abortions, in a place like Rangoon, you have doctors potentially who will still perform abortions safely even if they're not legal. The methods are extraordinarily crude. They're almost always going to involve some sort of blunt object being inserted inside a woman, whether it's a stick or a piece of metal. And the other most common traditional method is to use a combination of herbs and then pummeling massage, often with hot rocks, on a woman's abdomen, which can create a lot of problems if a woman is farther along in her pregnancy in terms of uterine perforation. Both methods are highly dangerous, and they're very apt to lead to infection, to sepsis, to hemorrhage, and because women are often scared to seek treatment, even though seeking treatment is legal, even in a context where abortion isn't, they often let those infections become dire before they are seen at a clinic or at a hospital. And because access is really difficult, you know, if you have a bad infection inside Eastern Burma, you're likely days walk away from any sort of clinic where there's a reliable source of antibiotics. And that means that common complications that could be handled in a Western context are much more likely to be fatal in a migrant or context inside of Eastern Burma.
I'm wondering, I hadn't experienced this at all in Burma, but is there the kind of resistance to medical information you might get in like Southern Africa, whereas you have people performing local sort of folk cures who have a vested interest in not seeing this medical information disseminated and saying, you know, these other practices are unsafe. You really ought to try this sort of massage pummeling method.
To some extent, I think it depends on the population, where there's a subset of traditional birth attendants who are doing some of these traditional methods who are most likely very set in their ways and may or may not be open to harm reduction information or, you know, information about other safer ways to do what they're doing or, you know, medical techniques. On the other hand, you have a huge population of medics who have, you know, maybe 6 months training in general around trauma or around emergency obstetrics, maybe general family practice care. And those are often the highest level medical personnel that are available in migrant communities or especially inside Eastern Burma. When I say migrant communities, I mean people who have fled to Thailand. And those medics are just so hungry for medical information. Mm-hmm. And there what's really interesting is that the idea that abortion is performed safely and legally in other contexts is really huge and eye-opening for people, right? Mm-hmm. That there's this perception that abortion, because it's the only kind of abortion people have seen there, is dangerous and life-threatening and likely to cause incredible harm. And so the information that in other contexts it's safe and women don't need to die is huge and really can change people's perception of whether or not, what they think about whether or not abortion should be legal or accessible, right? And so that's been fascinating, I think.
That's really interesting. So your organization is primarily disseminating information, is that correct, or running sort of training and that kind of thing?
A lot of the work that I do, I shouldn't say that I'm with an organization. I'm a consultant, so depending on which organization I work with, we do different, work. With adolescents, primarily we're working around emergency contraception and family planning. And then the work we do is around supplies as well as curriculum and information. And my background is actually in law and policy, so some of the work I do involves creating materials around sexual and reproductive rights as human rights that peer trainers and organizers can use. And then some work certainly involves talking about what abortion policy is like in other areas of the world, and how other areas of the world have been able to reduce harm from unsafe abortion.
So is emergency contraception something that's even available to these groups?
It really depends on where people are, because when people are in Thailand, emergency contraception is totally available. The Thai government, especially the Thai monarchy, has been very supportive of family planning for the last 30 years, which is wonderful. So you can get emergency contraception in a Thai pharmacy. You can get a dose for about $2, which is also about what a month's worth of oral contraceptives cost in Thailand. Wonderful. The problem, of course, with Burmese populations is that they often don't speak Thai, and that because they're in Thailand illegally, it's impossible for them to easily travel to a pharmacy to buy this or to travel to a clinic, because anytime somebody leaves a factory compound, the home where they're working as a domestic servant, the restaurant where they're washing dishes, they're at risk for being picked up by Thai immigration police and potentially detained, potentially deported, in some cases. While we want to be clear that the Thai authorities have been really welcoming to Burmese people and good, there's still a lot of abuse that happens with illegal migrants, beatings, and sexual assaults. So accessing healthcare in Thailand is a really dangerous proposition for Burmese migrants, which makes accessing something like EC as difficult as accessing anything else. And knowledge about EC is really low. In this same adolescent reproductive health report that ARHN just put together, it turned out that while, well over 60% of migrant youth knew common methods of contraception like condoms and oral contraceptive pills, less than a fifth of them had any idea that emergency contraception was available.
Wow. So I should have asked this earlier, but the groups we're talking about, I think the outside perception of Burma, as with most countries, tends to be more unified than it actually is, given how many minorities are in Burma and elsewhere. So which minorities are we talking about, and do they speak English or Burmese? Because I think something like 40% of people in Burma speak neither language, which makes the idea of sort of a unified democratic Burma seem less likely.
Yeah, this is a really fascinating area of the world, and by that I mean sort of northern and eastern Burma, because there are so many different ethnic groups that have their own language. So when we talk about those groups, we're talking about the Karen as one of the major groups, and they've been fighting the Burmese regime for probably the longest, but also the Kareni, the Kachin, the Lahu, the Shan, the Rohingya, the Arakanese. There are probably 12 major groups, and then another, I don't know, maybe 15 or 20 more that are small. And so it often means that when we're doing trainings, we're doing trainings in English and either Karen and Burmese as the sort of major translated language. And then almost certainly after the information is translated once, there are going to be two or three side conversations where other people are translating into Shan or into Lahu for their peers who are present who don't speak either Burmese or English.
I wanted to talk a little bit about fundraising. This is something I've been talking about a lot recently. The International Crisis Group released a report recently, and in that report, this was about Cyclone Nargis and the recovery effort, and in that report they stated that the Burmese receive about 1/20 of the aid you would expect for a country this poor. And I'm wondering what it's like trying to fundraise and get people to donate to such a fraught part of the world.
Well, I think there's sort of easy things and really difficult things, right? The sort of easy part is that money goes an incredibly long way along the Burmese border. You know, when you can buy a month's worth of contraception for $2 and you can pay a peer trainer for a month's work with $100, a $10,000 grant can do amazing things. So that's a big plus. I think a much harder part is that getting aid into Burma itself, so not in migrant communities, not in the refugee camps in Thailand, but physically back into Burma, always has a lot of extra costs because you need to get it into a country that won't allow foreigners in and often is trying to control the movement of its own population, and people are trying to evade that control by moving illegally. And when people are moving illegally, their transportation costs are much higher, right? And when they're trying to bring things like medical supplies or development supplies in, those costs are going to be a lot higher. And so it's really difficult to think about large-scale, sustainable ways to raise funds or to create change in eastern Burma with the regime in place because they don't want foreign aid into areas where they've had counterinsurgency warfare for 6 decades. And it's just really difficult to create any sort of large-scale sustainable programs in that context. Now, that being said, local groups are able to make it happen. And again, the sort of upside is that, you know, on a relatively small scale, especially in migrant areas, they can make big things happen, but it often means that they're doing things like building a clinic on the Thai side of a river, knowing that people will be able to sneak across and access supplies there. I'm not sure if that totally answered your question, Carrie.
It does. It makes sense that in a migrant context, you'd have to have a lot of ad hoc. I mean, nothing's going to be permanent because you never know when it's going to be knocked down or whatever, especially with you sort of anyone in crisis. The stuff I've been writing about has more to do less with sort of civil war-torn communities, more with Burmese who've been affected by Cyclone Nargis or other sort of cyclical natural disasters. I mean, there's constantly floods or what have you. And I've been talking to various people from the UN who are frustrated because there are different kinds of aid available. There's humanitarian aid, which is relatively uncontroversial. So aid for emergency reasons, like emergency medical care and food and medicine and these various things that nobody's going to contest. Then there's this other thing, development, which is seen as being long-term and involves houses and agriculture, and that is completely fraught, and there is just huge resistance to that from the sort of democracy activist side of things. And so on one side, you have people who are saying, look, there's never going to be any change unless we can help build some kind of middle class, and anyway, it doesn't do anyone any good to see these people starving. Yeah. But then the sort of democracy activist side of things is saying, well, any long-term investment in this country is only aiding and abetting the regime. Go ahead.
I'm sorry, I didn't interrupt you. But I think you hit on one of the most important tensions around democracy activists and Burma in general right now, right? Which is that for the last maybe 15 years, the policy of most democracy activists, especially those outside of Burma, and the U.S. and a lot of the Western community has been to try to isolate the regime in any way possible with this idea that it can be weakened enough so that it will fall. And I think you may know more about this than I do, but there seem to be increasing calls or sort of discussions within the democracy activist community as well as sort of more broadly that with China and India and Thailand all choosing to economically engage this regime, that it may well be that things like development aid or engagement will provide some openings for a gradual transition of the regime losing power. And I don't know if that's something that that you've been thinking a lot about or talking about, but it's something that I hear quite often where I work.
Yeah, and I actually find both sides quite implausible. I mean, I don't certainly this policy of half the world not engaging Burma while others engage, there's no hope for the regime just being starved into submission. And the other side of things saying engaging will cause political change, I don't know that it will, but at the same time, politics aren't the whole world. So I was talking about development aid and the various controversies surrounding it. It's much different from the regions you work in, which are much more migrant-driven, but in, say, the Delta, which has been struck so severely by Cyclone Nargis, various UN agencies, UNDP and so forth, have been working in this sort of devastated zone to provide emergency humanitarian aid-related things like medicines for waterborne diseases and food and temporary shelter, very temporary shelter, like plastic tarps. And at this point, many months later, people are still living under plastic tarps. And the reason is, or part of the reason is, that the UN can't go beyond that humanitarian aid. They can't begin to build homes, which would be more permanent. They can't give advice on various agricultural techniques, which is seen as development as opposed to humanitarian aid. And I think people working in development find this immensely frustrating. They find this restriction unnecessary. Nobody believes that humanitarian aid or development aid can reasonably go through the government. But what the UN or the people I was speaking to were saying was that they can get these funds in without going through the government, and they're not being allowed to do that because of various restrictions.
Various restrictions on the UN side, you mean, as opposed to restrictions in Burma or restrictions on both sides?
Yeah, sanctions-driven restrictions, so restrictions on what the UN is allowed to do with the money it has. And those are driven by the idea that any development aid, anything long-term, is inherently aiding and abetting the regime. It has nothing to do with the regime, the restrictions that the regime might impose, which are there but tend to be highly variable.
And as you said, are often dependent on local leaders, right?
Right.
And that's
right.
Also true in the East, where the local leaders are much more likely to be militia commanders on both sides, but it's really their word that's law, as opposed to the larger government policy, which generally doesn't tend to have a lot of force in ceasefire zones or in any of the active conflict zones. I do think the idea of the sanctions, though, affecting what would be really good aid is an interesting one, because it's certainly something that comes up in the context of the work that I've done, that it's very difficult to transfer money to any organization that's a community-based Burmese group if it has Burma anywhere in its name. Mm. And so, I'm really lucky that a lot of our aid goes through a group called Burma Border Projects, which has gone through the process of getting these special letters, I think through the Treasury or the State Department, that allow its funds to go to Thai accounts that have Burmese names on them without the same level of scrutiny that often otherwise stops really well-intentioned donations that are going to humanitarian groups. And so I think in lots of ways those sanction rules are difficult right now, right? And that it's difficult to know what strategies will be useful in trying to bring democratic change to a country that's in the situation that Burma is in today.
Yeah, and of course, as you were saying, given those sanctions and various other difficulties, it makes a lot of sense to put aid groups on the Thai border in Thailand, where it's just immensely less complicated. And I don't think a lot of people understand that so many of the groups that, quote-unquote, work in Burma are working on the Thai border with Burmese migrants who are coming over and coming back. What is that border like?
It's a fascinating place. The border is often very porous, and then sometimes it is very, very difficult to cross. So often the Thai government will at least quasi-tolerate folks coming over, especially for training and education purposes, for things that aren't aren't going to be directly destabilizing to its neighbors. So when medics want to come over for a specific medical training, it's often possible if they come and stay in a facility that's only 1 kilometer from the border in Thailand, a place where foreign doctors can easily travel, and nobody even goes into town 2 kilometers away, but everybody stays at this facility out in the field, that everything will be fine. On the other hand, there are times when for either very specific reasons, like violence occurring, if there's a high-level assassination of a militia leader, especially if it's inside Thailand, or if there's a bomb that goes off somewhere, or sometimes if it's Thai government stuff, right? If there's some instability on the Thai side, or just because there's a change in policy, suddenly the border can just snap shut, which doesn't mean that people still can't sneak across the river somewhere, but bringing across a group of people with, you know, any sort of tacit approval just can't happen. And so when you're planning to do trainings or do work in this area, you always have to build in a lot of flexibility because it's often, you know, well, we plan to start on January 5, but nobody from Shan State can come. Like, you know, well, when do we think they'll be able to come? Maybe next week. Maybe not.
About,
you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, you never know.
What about, say, mothers who come over to deliver children with the help of these medics? Are they then sometimes stuck on the Thai side?
Sometimes, although it's much more likely that they're going to be stuck on the Burmese side, right? Mm-hmm. It's a rare case where Thai officials aren't going to be happy to send somebody who's illegally in Thailand from Burma right back to Burma if they ask nicely to go.
Right.
But what can happen is that people who are seeking medical care, especially in Mae Sot, which is a town where there's a major border crossing between Thailand and Burma, can get stuck on the Burmese side. So Mae Sot is interesting. There's this, you know, veritable army of NGOs in Mae Sot, all trying to get aid either into Burma or into migrant areas along the Thai-Burma border. And also in Mae Sot, there's this amazing clinic that the Thai government has been incredibly generous in tolerating. It's called the Mae Tau Clinic. It's run by a Burmese doctor, Dr. Cynthia, who's been called the Mother Teresa of Burma. She's a really incredible person. And the Mae Tau Clinic serves about 100,000 people a year, both from migrant communities, but also from inside Burma. And so people will often walk for 2 or 3 days if they're able, or carry someone through the jungle for up to a couple days to try to reach this clinic, because it's one of, you know, the only places where they can receive specialized medical care. And specialized is really relative in this context, right? We're really lucky if there's 1 or 2 doctors at the clinic at any given time. But for mothers, it's a really, really important resource, because Eastern Burma has a huge lack of trained birth attendants, skilled birth attendants. And so maternal mortality rates inside Eastern Burma are some of the highest in the world. It's very similar to sub-Saharan Africa, where estimates are anywhere between a 1 in 12 and a 1 in 20 chance of a lifetime maternal mortality risk from pregnancy, unsafe abortion, or labor and delivery. So a place like the Mae Tau Clinic that has the ability to give blood transfusions, to offer things like misoprostol to prevent postpartum hemorrhage is huge. A lot of the issues that the clinic sees are women who are chronically malnourished, but also who have endemic malaria. And as I think you probably know, too, from working inside Burma, that malaria is very common, especially in the east, and that, you know, for researchers, it's this really interesting malaria because it's multiple drug resistant, but that means it's very hard to treat. And women who have malaria are also have a really high risk of being anemic, and women who are anemic have much higher risk of bleeding out because of labor and delivery. So death from hemorrhage, postpartum hemorrhage, as well as unsafe abortion are both huge, huge in this population.
And what is the birth rate like? I mean, this is it just a risk that's going to compound over your lifetime as you're having more children?
Yeah, because access to family planning and knowledge about family planning are low in Eastern Burma, but also, you know, it's a context that you could sort of liken to Palestinians, right? Mm-hmm. Where there's a really strong impetus of these small ethnic minority groups to keep their population high. So early marriage is still really commonly accepted. I mean, it's also that there aren't a lot of educational opportunities, but it means that women often start having their first baby at around 15 or 16, and they keep having babies. And so a lot of estimates from inside the East are that women have probably 7 or 8 pregnancies or live births over the course of a lifetime. And then that falls in context in Thailand. So it becomes somewhat lower in refugee camp settings. I think there it's much more likely that women probably have between 4 and 5 live births. And again, falls when women are in migrant settings. And migrants are highly mobile, and there are also huge risks that women incur in getting pregnant. I mean, if you get pregnant in a village setting, it doesn't, you know, other than the risks of pregnancy, it doesn't change your life in a huge way. But if you're working in a factory or on a farm or in someone's house in Thailand, you know, there's no pregnancy discrimination protection, and most employers don't want to have a pregnant woman or a nursing mother on staff. And so women really face job loss if they have a baby, and then have to figure out how to provide security and food for a baby in a context where transportation risks are really high and their lives are really unstable, which is why it appears that family planning as well as unsafe abortion rates probably both go up a lot for migrants and birth rates fall.
I see. Yeah, it seems like the kind of environment in which abortion rates would just be astronomically high, whether safe or unsafe, given all of the risks involved and the losses.
Yeah, I think especially if, so I hope people don't take this the wrong way. I think if there was a safe alternative for abortion, that rates would probably be even higher than they are. Mm-hmm. But it's true that even though women risk death if they have an unsafe abortion, the rates are really high because often women are in situations where they just can't figure out a way that they could have or raise a child. It also means that there are a lot of unaccompanied children, right, which I think is true in a lot of refugee and conflict settings, but that safe houses are really important. So I think it's another way, if people are ever interested in getting involved with direct humanitarian aid around Eastern Burma in particular, supporting safe houses and boarding houses for children can be really important because migrants, as well as people who are inside Eastern Burma in dangerous places, tend to try to get children into these safe houses in refugee camps or in places that are well tolerated in migrant areas where they're supported by social welfare groups. And so you have 50, 60, 100 kids in 3 or 4 houses and a makeshift school that's sort of built up around them. And those types of groups can always really use help from Westerners in the most basic sense, right? Food and clothes and education are really key for those children whose parents are trying to put together jobs or are somehow involved in the conflict.
And again, it's the kind of thing where a single Western dollar goes a long way, right? Because we're not talking about Bangkok, we're talking about these quite poor northern parts of Thailand on the border.
Yeah, you know, I was talking to a good friend of mine who has supported a boarding house for the last 5 years, and his donor, because of the financial crisis, is probably going to be pulling out. So how much money are you looking at? So we have 130 kids. So to keep them fed, clothed, and in school, given that they get basic rice and oil rations in refugee camp, we need $26,000 for 130 kids for a year.
Wow.
Yeah, so it's
so, I mean, it's, one kid's 1 year of college tuition.
It's like, I think, $250 a kid. Now, my lack of math skills and my law background will come in. But it's a really small amount of money that people need. And that's also really true with reproductive health care. And yeah, apologies with the technical difficulties if I happen to mention this before, but it's really inexpensive to get supplies around reproductive health care together along the border. You know, where 3 months of birth control pills is like $10 in Thailand. And so you can do a lot with a small amount of money for both health care and just taking care of people in this area. It's not like Bangkok or Hong Kong. It's a really cheap place to at least take care of people.
And so a dollar that went to the Reproductive Health Network would be supporting these kinds of boarding houses? And, I mean, where does that money go specifically?
Sure. If people gave to this Adolescent Reproductive Health Network, whose study we've been talking about, primarily that money will go to education and supplies for teenagers. So that money is really going to go to condoms, birth control pills, Depo-Provera, pregnancy tests, emergency contraception, and then funding the salaries of the people who go out and train these peer trainers who then train other teenagers. And those salaries are like $50 to $150 a month per person, depending on whether or not they're part-time or full-time. And again, the wonderful thing about giving through Burma Border Projects, Burma Border Projects will, you know, take donations for the Adolescent Reproductive Health Network, is okay. that they pass through all of the money. And when we do much bigger grants, they pass through 98.5% of the money. But essentially, all of your money goes straight to the border and to Burmese groups. And, you know, like people, I think, in poverty and conflict anywhere, they can stretch a dollar really far.
And I think it's important to emphasize that the organizations that the network is working with, they're community-based Burmese organizations, right?
Yeah.
I mean, they're not Western NGOs.
No, these are all Burmese people and Burmese groups. And so they're folks like the United Lahu Youth Organization, right, which has leaders in their 20s from Lahu State, and the Karen Women's Organization, which is sort of the grandma of women's empowerment organizations on the border. So they're all Burmese-staffed, Burmese-led organizations that don't have outside Western salaries or leadership. They're really from the community, which is a lot of the reason why they're effective. Right? If a Western group came in and started a youth center by the factories outside of Mesa, you know, I don't think we would get anywhere. But when ARHN, this wonderful, you know, local collection of groups, started a youth center just 3 months ago, it was still greeted with these sort of questions, right, from local schools and communities, like, what does it mean if you're going to talk about family planning, right? Will you encourage people to have sex? And so there still had to be all sorts of discussions with local leaders, but because it's coming from the community, it has been accepted. Kids from factories and kids from migrant schools are using it, and it provides an important place then for people to drop in, to get information, to get family planning or pregnancy tests if they need or want it, but also to get together for things like there's a weekly singing, guitar, you know, strumming group, and a lending library. So I think it's one of those nice, if not guarantees, at least really encouraging factors that if you give money directly to these local groups, you're much more likely to see that money have an impact on the ground with people who need it most.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's costs and benefits. One of the problems you don't create by donating to groups like that is this kind of dual economy, which you see in Rangoon, where you've got just people with immense amounts of money working for NGOs who are, and you know, the people who are delivering them tea have college educations, and perhaps that human capital could be better used somewhere else, but you just have these sort of massive distortions, which is not to say that I don't think World Vision should be working in Burma. I do, but it does create kind of unintentional consequences.
Yeah, it's interesting, and I think sometimes local folks and far less, I've heard this from Burmese people as opposed to sort of local expats who are on local salaries, I think can have a lot of hostility to some of the larger organizations working on much, much, much larger budgets in the area. And my perception is that both are very useful, right? It is very useful in a lot of contexts to have international groups come in to be working under international human rights norms and to be doing things like conducting long-term research or trying to improve governance standards. And I think those things are important in conflict and post-conflict situations, but it's also true that if you really want to stretch a dollar and want to make sure it's in the hands of local communities, that you just can't beat local community groups. So they certainly have different comparative advantages in terms of the work that they do.
Yeah, I mean, one of the benefits of having expats, and this is kind of why I saw myself as somewhat useful in the position of journalist, is that you can take risks that Burmese people can't take. So, for instance, I was reporting on stuff, most of my stories were censored, but I was reporting on stuff that was sensitive enough that I don't think a lot of Burmese reporters would have wanted to touch it, and the only risk I ran was being deported,
right.
Whereas they obviously ran much more severe risks. And that's actually part of the reason why the story of John Yetta, I don't actually know how to pronounce his name, but the guy who, the American who showed up at Suchi's doorstep is so interesting.
Yeah, the Mormon who decided to swim across the lake in homemade flippers one night.
Yeah, there's a picture of his flippers, I think, on like, I'm not sure where I saw it, but they're definitely homemade flippers that he fashioned himself to swim the 2 kilometers over Inyo Lake.
Yeah, I think it is interesting because you're right that in general, what you're risking as a Westerner, and I think part of the reason it seems like we're useful in a place where we obviously cost a lot more to send over, right, both in travel and in any sort of salary, is that we're able to take these risks, right? One of the most important things I think about, what I do is that I can move around as well as sort of the connections I bring to the U.S. and bringing, doctors.
Right.
I have freedom of movement, right? None of the people I work with have the ability to move freely around Thailand, which means you can send me and the doctor I'm with to a different setting, to a refugee camp, and those sorts of connections are important. But it is really rare for a Westerner to do something either foolish or publicity-seeking or crazy enough to get arrested, right? Like, the SPDC is generally pretty happy just to blacklist us and keep us out of the country. So, both sort of like kudos and, oh, my God, what were you thinking with this guy, right?
Well, it's so interesting because, when you live in Rangoon, and I'm sure you've experienced this, I mean, all of the codes that you're following are unspoken, right? Like, so it's not that Suchi is really well guarded. You just don't go there. And it's not that various government buildings are that you're going to be shot the moment you enter them. It's just that nobody tries it. And so to have someone show up who's kind of off and maybe not quite in tune with all these sort of like everything in the ether and also like on a mission from God.
Right. Like he's on a mission from God, right?
Yeah.
Like,
it's amazing what you can get away with. And I often thought that when I was living in Burma, like, I know that right now I'm in public and I can't talk about Suchi or democracy or a million other things. But what if I wasn't attuned to this? What would my life be like if I wasn't like constantly getting these signals of, don't do this and this is verboten and you'll be kicked out if you do this. And John Yetta is that like other part of your psychology, who's like, just does it.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. Let's see what happens, right? What if I did do this crazy thing? And I think, again, it's very different working in Thailand because while Thailand has its own special restrictions on freedom of speech that are far, far, far less restrictive than Burma, but, you have to be careful with some things. It's fine to wear an Aung San Suu Kyi shirt, right? And people wear them everywhere. It's fine to have a poster of her on the wall. It's fine to talk about what a wonderful thing democracy in Burma would be in public. But it's really dangerous to take pictures of anybody, right? Or to do an interview with anybody there because everybody knows that media is monitored enough by the SPDC that could not only get that person in trouble, but members of their family back in Burma. And that a lot of the activists I work with, whether it's women's empowerment or reproductive health, not necessarily dissidents or democracy activists, haven't ever told their family inside Burma what they're doing. That often people explain that they're going to be going to school or that they're working in a factory when in fact they're working in a women's empowerment group or a youth empowerment group because if it becomes widely known that they're associated with those groups, that there could be problems for them or for people who are close to them. So I think that's interesting. It's a different level again than if you're in Rangoon, but it's still, you can still feel the power of the regime in those areas.
Do you have a sense of the political leanings of a lot of the groups that you're working with? I mean, I imagine that they would be quite complex and wouldn't follow this very simple narrative of we want Suu Kyi immediately and that she's sometimes seen as privileging the Burman minority as opposed to others, and Burma isn't the, unity we think it is.
I think that on the surface, everybody is supportive of Suu Kyi, and everyone is supportive of democracy. And then as soon as you scratch the surface, it becomes clear that part of the reason why there's been endemic counterinsurgency warfare for 60 years is that all of these small groups have slightly different agendas, right? And that I think part of the part of the problem at this point is that a lot of militias have functioned for a long enough time that they have their own needs and power structures and incentives. And then there are also sort of more traditional leaders. There are more sort of democracy-based leaders. And it's not clear what everyone needs or wants most out of a potentially democratic Burma, right? It is clear that having this regime go away is not going to solve the problem of Eastern Burma, that there were tensions for hundreds of years before the British came. The British, you know, for all the bad of colonialization anywhere in the world, the British were really quite loved in Eastern Burma because they were seen as protectors for these small groups against a majority that many groups had traditionally felt was oppressive. And so, you know, what is clear is that the future is going to be complicated. And I think that, you know, what I have heard most are sort of ideas about having in the future a weaker central government and more autonomy for some of the regions of Eastern Burma. But things like geographical lines and who is able to control development on the Salween River or you know, the hydroelectric dams that may or may not be built anytime soon, the timber and mining concessions that are clearly going to drive economic development there and do currently. I think all that means that beyond Suu Kyi and beyond the regime, I mean, Burma will have some really tough issues to sort out when it comes to integrating the entire country into one nation that has a populace that feels that all of their human rights are being respected. Mm-hmm. You know, by whatever government exists.
Have you, is there conflict on the border within these groups that are being helped by various NGOs? Is there conflict between, you know, the various groups at all, or is it?
Less so, you know, women's empowerment groups, you know, don't particularly have big conflicts per se, right? They may have different agendas when they all get together in the Burmese Women's Union and they try to sort out their yearly plan. You know, it's much more that, you know, the SPDC has done a very good job, for instance, with the Karen of splitting the major Karen military groups so that they're now fighting each other, and one of them is being funded by the SPDC and one isn't. So that sort of inter-ethnic problem definitely exists and makes everything much more complicated. You know, you know, when I first got to this region, and I really like international affairs. I usually, you know, like to read a lot about them. But it took me about a year of reading the history before I felt like I had any idea what different groups wanted and why everybody was fighting. Right? Like, yeah. It really took some sorting out and some heavy duty reading. It's not a simple, you know, one side versus another situation. There are a lot of players in the region, and then if you mix in India and Bangladesh and China and Thailand, you know, wow.
Yeah. Completely. Well, can you tell us where we should go if we're interested in donating to various groups?
Yes. Burma Border Projects is the best and easiest place to go to donate money. And if you want it to go to reproductive health, please, you know, indicate in whatever line you send the check or in an email, Adolescent Reproductive Health Network, ARHN. That's the easiest place. The Maytau Clinic, Maytau is spelled M-A-E and then space T-A-O. The Maytau Clinic also has a website, and you can't go wrong donating to the Maytau Clinic. Like, they are, you know, they're doing the Lord's work, and I say that as a secular person. Like, they're
on a mission from God.
Yeah, they're on a mission from God. Like, they're birthing babies and they're giving people artificial legs, and you know, it's a good place for your money to go. And so either of those places would be wonderful. And nobody in the U.S. is going to take that money. You're not going to find any U.S. person's salary. It's all going to go to the border.
So. Okay, well, thanks so much, Carrie, and I hope we can do this again after your next trip.
Thank you, Carrie. It was lovely to talk to you. Have a
you
great
too.
Day.
Bye.
Bye.